Current events, politics, technology, opinion, and theology. We are the Warriors on the Wall podcast.
Welcome to episode 2 of Warriors on the Wall. My name is James Edwards. Go ahead and introduce yourselves, guys.
I'm Travis.
I'm Steve, and I have never barfed, nor have I ever yawned.
Of course, Steve is our comedy piece, you know, since he is Canadian.
That must be it.
That's got to be it. Blame Canada for everything.
Right.
So this week's, episode of Warriors on the Wall, we're going to talk a little bit about several topics that have kind of popped their heads out over the last couple of weeks. And first off, we're going to talk about politics in the pulpit. Has your pastor ever told you to vote for a specific candidate? If so, what are your feelings about that? So we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're also going to talk about the Johnson Amendment, which basically prevents or gets in the way of churches being able to speak their political affiliation. And we're going to go from there. And then we're also going to talk a little bit about Babylon Bee and just kind of whatever other hijinks we can get into in the next hour or so. So stay tuned, and we're going to get to it here in a minute.
Right now, it's hard to explain, but we're very concerned why the prices are high.
Made a new record. Very, very expensive. We're on the attack.
All right, guys. So our thoughts on politics and the pulpit. So let's go ahead and talk a little bit about that. Steve, what are your feelings on all of that?
Well, I was hoping Travis would go first because, granted, I've only lived in the States for like about a total of 3 years of my life. And I wasn't anywhere where they focused on a candidate. I was there during the 2004 election, and I remember it was just expected, you know, Christians are going to vote Republican. They're going to, you know, vote for Bush and stuff. But it was kind of interesting to me because I don't expect to see that in my own culture. You know, I'm Canadian, as you mentioned. You know, there's always been more than two parties running in any election, and you don't usually hear a pastor, or you don't usually hear someone using the pulpit to talk about the elections. And if they do, it's in this kind of like, you know, don't forget to vote on Tuesday type of way. Whereas like, you know, like I said, I remember when I was in Bible school, they had voter registration forms in the foyer. I said foyer for you guys. And as opposed to foyer. And
you could have said foyer, we would have understood.
Right. Well, when I was in North Carolina, that's how I heard people pronounce it. But I'm
they say it in Alabama because I'm not really sure.
That's how I say it. I say four.
Right. But I remember that because the Bible school I went to had moved from Florida to North Carolina, and this was the first election. They made this announcement, or the ushers would make announcements that, you know, if people needed to register, they had Republican voter registration forms in the foyer. And I put up my hand and I said, well, what if you're not voting Republican? And everybody just looked at me. You know what I mean? Like, how could you not? And I'd say, well, I'm not. And they're like, what? Why would you not? And it's like, well, I don't vote in American elections for one. But I remember feeling like it was a bit presumptive to just kind of only offer the one party, the one form, you know, instead of like, say, all of them that there are or something. Like I wasn't used to that kind of thing. I wouldn't see it in my culture. So, Travis?
Mate, you didn't know Jesus was a Republican?
I did not.
Yeah, I've been in three different kinds of churches. You know, one that they just straight push one political party, and then one where they actually laid out balanced issues from the pulpit. They didn't what was the word for it? They didn't push any particular candidate. I like that and better from behind the pulpit. You know, lay out all the candidates, what issues they are, and then the biblical response behind each one of them. But then you also have these other churches that, oh, Jesus was a Republican, you know, we did vote for Republican. And, yeah. But, all right, what are your thoughts, James?
Well, coming at this from the angle of, first off, you know, I'll kind of start off my thoughts with the Johnson Amendment. So back in 1954, Lyndon B. Johnson, who later became a president of the United States, actually sponsored and had a bill passed that prevented churches, namely any nonprofit organization that actually received money from the government, from being able to talk about their political affiliations at all, which, in my opinion, is a violation of our First Amendment right, free speech, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. However, my biggest thing with it is I don't really believe that it's the church's responsibility to be involved in politics. So I kind of sit on the fence in that. So really, my you know, I had a pastor a while back ago, and you know, he's still a very close friend of mine. I will leave it as vague as possible because I don't want to call him out. But he is a huge Trump supporter, and he has been a diehard, rabid Trump supporter since day one, when there were several other more qualified candidates running than Trump. And he was a Trump guy from the very get-go. And it really bothered me because, you know, when it comes down to it, there were some really good candidates that were running and could have really used the support of people like him. And who knows, the election could have actually been moving in a different direction had they actually paid attention to the real issues instead of just going for the most polarizing character in the election. And this pastor friend of mine, he actually does electioneer from the pulpit. And, you know, if some people hear that, they would then classify that as breaking the law or whatever. I don't believe that that should be even the case, or that someone should lose their tax exemption for that reason. Because honestly, when you look at other 501c3 organizations, they are organizations out there that are considered nonprofit, but they are only political organizations. A lot of PACs, political action committees, and super PACs are kind of in that same vein as well. They're 501c3 organizations, I'm pretty sure. So that's kind of my thoughts on it. I have a hard time understanding why pastors want to be involved, but at the same time, I also don't believe that government should really be able to tell them that they can't be involved.
Well, those two points you just made, that the pastors shouldn't be and that the government shouldn't, you know, hinder them. Yeah, I 100% agree with that. How about this? Obviously, you know, what they're talking about has to do with a church that has, you know, the 501c3 status, and you know, there's this iffy waters about, like, should they be pulpiteering? But what is a pulpit? You know, if do we want to get technical and talk about a pastor who has an audience on a Sunday morning and is preaching the word and shares his or her opinion? What you could obey that law. You could you know, preach the word and then just incessantly post on Facebook all your political views. You know what I mean? And maybe have thousands and thousands and thousands more followers on your Facebook than the 200 people sitting in your pew on a Sunday morning. So you could be influencing infinitely more people with your social media than you are the pulpit. You know, right. So is it like a spirit of the law versus like the letter of the law?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and to bring it back a little bit on that, there was and just to try to keep it as vague as possible, a friend of mine actually was on staff at a church, and this was out west somewhere. And basically, he said that in a staff meeting the head pastor had told everyone on the staff that they were to vote for Trump. And he came back and he said he wasn't voting for Trump. He was voting for Cruz, and nothing that the head pastor could say would change his mind. And needless to say, the relationship kind of went south over the next few months. And ultimately, that guy was terminated from that church. So I have, that's another part where I have a hard time about it is, you know, do we actually look at our church as a political grandstand, or should we use that kind of office and our authority in that office to try to influence people, or should we, you know, do what God told us to do, and that was to preach the gospel unhindered by any of the worldly convictions that we typically do? What are your thoughts on that?
You should not ever tell your congregation who to vote for and who to vote against, period. I mean, that, for one thing, it's a captive audience. For the second thing, say if you're inferring that someone to vote for somebody because that's the quote, godly thing to do, you're essentially telling the other person that if they obey their conscience and vote for somebody else, that they are sinning. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah. Steve, you had you can come off the mic there and tell us what you think.
The example you just gave where the line was drawn in the sand and everybody was pressured or encouraged to vote for a particular candidate, that makes my blood boil a little bit for various reasons, not just, you know, what if the person's conscience is, no, I don't feel that that's how to use my vote. But also the pastoral friend, like, to me, that seems like the kind of violation that that Johnson law aims to curtail, right? Like that kind of thing where a pastor might be using his pulpit or pressuring his staff or whatever to vote a certain way. That is directly imposing your own view, your own point of view, your own voting preferences on other people and not allowing them the space to vote the way they would prefer. So for me, that would be an example of like why such a Johnson law exists, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I get that and I understand that point, but I'd still struggle with the wording of the law in addition to, because, you know, it says that it's for all nonprofits, you know, and I've got the Wikipedia page, you know how faithful Wikipedia is. I've got that pulled up, actually outlining the actual amendment itself. And in it, he basically challenges the 501c3 organization in general to not speak about who they're for or who they're against, which there in of itself, which I'm sure if we did a Google search, we could find many 501c3 organizations that's what they do. Their entire reason for existing is to electioneer. So, you know, where that comes in, I have no idea how in the world they're able to get away with it, but the amendment is actually rearing its ugly head when it comes to churches. My thought is this, and I've had this discussion with several people. I personally believe that as a Christian, I cannot rightly support abortion. I cannot rightly support homosexual marriage. I cannot rightly support different types of social engineering programs or things like that, because if I do, to me, it not only goes against my conscience, but I believe it goes against the Word of God. Whereas on the social side of things, being a social libertarian to some extent, I believe that, you know, when it comes to homosexual marriage, I don't care what you do as long as you don't rub it in my face. When it comes to abortion, I do care about that as far as that goes, but I don't think that government really should be involved either one way or another in that particular thing. Abortion should really be a doctor's kind of thing, and there should be some limitations put on it by law, but it should not be a to or against law. Does that make sense what I'm saying, or am I just rambling?
No, it makes sense, and I get your hesitation with this law. I mean, I never heard of it until this conversation, but I think what I'm trying to navigate is you know, like I think even in the way you prefaced this section of the conversation, that there's that, there's the government stepping in when they shouldn't, and then there's, you know, should pastors be pulpiteering. And in the example you gave about your friend in vague terms, like for me, it doesn't matter if there's like a law about it or not. Like that's a wrong way to go about it.
Right. Yeah.
So I agree. I understand what you're trying to say. Travis?
I'm trying to find why the Johnson Law was originally put into place. I read about it 10 years ago. But wasn't it to keep the pastors from preaching out against the Democratic Party? Isn't that why he established it?
Well, if I remember right, Lyndon Johnson is a or was a Democrat.
He was.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So
he was JFK's VP.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. I remember that now. Yeah,
and a huge racist.
That he was too. It's well documented on that too. I mean, honestly, I don't know the specifics about that, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was the case, because it seems like most laws that are made are in one way or another to protect the power of those people that are in authority. And I wouldn't for a minute bat an eye at that if that's the case.
Yep. I'm just waiting to see if Travis has a response.
No, I'm drawing blanks right now.
Because unlike the last time, I'm trying to be quieter this conversation. Give Travis the space to share his thoughts.
Well, speaking of the Johnson Law, did you know that Trump's trying to repeal it?
I have heard that, but I think he's trying to repeal it in the sense that he's trying to gain the voters that would normally be opposed to it anyway. Well, so
that's his whole campaign, though, isn't it? He's just trying to appeal to the voters that he can get.
Right.
I mean, at one minute he's pro-life, and the next minute he's pro-choice. I mean, you know.
Yeah, and that's where I struggle the most with Trump himself, is that, you know, and I'm okay with people changing their viewpoints over the years. I mean, honestly, I have, just in the last 10 years alone, my social and fiscal politics have changed so much. I don't have a problem with people changing their views. What I have a problem with are people that vacillate back and forth, and they don't stay with one view or another. And then you've got people that are pounding the drum for, like, say, Trump, saying that he is a good man and all this kind of stuff, when in fact he is probably just as, for lack of a better term, just as morally bankrupt as Bill Clinton is, you know.
Would you say that he's a better candidate than the last one we had, Mitt Romney? I mean, because at least this guy is somewhat cultural Christian and not a totally different cult, you know. I mean, but think about it, all the evangelicals gathered behind Mitt Romney last election said, oh yeah, well, he's the one that God ordained. Apparently not. And now right. They're, you know, now a lot of the same evangelicals are saying, no, we're not going to vote for Trump because he's immoral.
Right.
And there's no consistency right there, because one's basically, it's almost a blaspheme because he's saying that Jesus and Lucifer are brothers, and then Trump is just, you know,
I think what you're touching on, Travis, with Trump and to me it's kind of, you know, the same thing with Romney, but especially more so this election with Trump, is that idea of how, you know, we made a joke like, well, isn't Jesus a Republican? the way that the church is so married to politics, and usually, you know, the right in this, in your country, it's, you know, down to Republican and Democrat. So it's almost like, I don't know, I'm an outsider looking in, so I'm treading lightly as it is. If we're gonna go down that path where the church is automatically expected to be voting right, in a sense, it's like I don't blame evangelical leaders if they buy into that system, that they have to endorse the candidate that system produces. And here he is, you know, a thrice divorced, totally arrogant, all these other criticisms you can launch at him, individual who just, you know, spend half an hour watching any of his speeches or something like that. You know, you may get good things out of it, but this is the candidate that the Christians are going to, you know, unite behind. And it was the same thing when it was Romney, but just not like as, do I want to say obvious, not as like out there of an endorsement, you know, like at least Mitt Romney, granted, you know, Mormonism is not really considered like a denomination or anything of the church. At least there was some common ground to be found, you know, in the church, in, you know, the Mormon church, where we could talk about his stance on things, you know, his family life, his sense of ethics and stuff, that there was more common ground to attempt to have. But with Trump, it's just kind of like, well, if we're going to go through with this, then yeah, we have to get behind this guy. So I think it's kind of a byproduct of the way the church is so married to politics in your country.
Now, hold up a second. Trump signed a commitment card. That means he's a Christian, right?
Maybe.
I do get what you're saying. I do get what you're saying, though. The whole Romney thing, at least he was a husband of one wife. You know, he had a somewhat poster card family, kind of like a Richard Nixon kind of. And you could argue that he was moral, might have been religiously wrong, but he was somewhat of a moral man, held to the, you get what I'm saying?
Well, when it comes down to it, you know, the last election, I did support Romney. And I was one of those people that kept saying, well, if you vote third party, you're voting for Obama or whatever. And, you know, and now I despise people that keep saying stuff like that, I guess, because I've kind of mutated and changed over the last few years when it comes to my politics.
See, I watch from the outside going, well, what's the problem? You know, because there's two kind of main parties. It'll usually be conservative or liberal in Canada, but there's this other thing called New Democratic Party, NDP. There's Bloc Québécois, there's Green Party. So like in October, when we had our elections, which mind you are, they're normally 6 weeks, but they were 11 weeks this time. It was arduous. Not these like year and a half, you know, where the president spends more time campaigning than he does running a country, you know, but they had like the debates with like five candidates. You know what I mean? I in my lifetime, we've never had an election where there was only two candidates, even if there may be two that are the front runners. So third party nonsense is not something, you know, a lot of other countries don't have just a two party system like America, you know, Canada being one of them. So for me, it's just kind of laughable when I watch people act like there's only two to pick from. You know, you're wasting your vote if whatever. You know, as long as people believe that.
There's actually five candidates that are running for the United States Office of President. Only two are getting a lot of press because that's typically how it goes. You've got Darrell Castle from the Constitution Party, which I like him a lot. You've got Jill Stein from the Green Party of America. She's a crazy leftist loony tunes person. There I go electioneering, I guess. You've got Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party, which, you know, there are a lot of libertarians that question whether or not he's truly a libertarian. And then you've got Trump running for the Republicans and Clinton running for the Democrats. So we have five candidates running. The problem is that the only two major candidates get on the ballots easily. Everyone else has to struggle to get on the ballots, and you know, and that's kind of the case in America. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. In Canada, how difficult, from your knowledge, is it for someone to get on the ballot?
It's not at all. But the thing is, we have a parliamentarian system, so every, you know, the whole country is divided into like 300 something. I think it's now like 338 seats, and each of those districts has a seat, and those local elections, you know, they take place the same time, and you vote on the person in your they call it a riding, or, you know, so my city, for example, we would vote on the local candidate that we want representing us in parliament. And then so say, for example, it's this liberal woman, so she's, you know, that's a seat for the Liberal Party. And the leader of that party is also running for his or her riding, and the party that gets the most seats, well, that's the party whose leader becomes the prime minister. So we've had, since I've been an adult, I think like three minority governments in a row where it's more of a first past the post election system, where you know, there's like 35 or 38% of the votes, or the popular vote, went to this party, but they didn't form a majority, you know, to be able to actually, you know, do anything in government. So like in a year or two, they have another election, because basically the government can't work, and they try to get a majority. And so you're actually voting for your local representative and not the leader to become the prime minister. So, I mean, that has its flaws. You know, the current government is trying to do an election reform. I don't know if, like, what there is to do about it, but there's pros and cons to both setups, right? And so the cons, you know, some of the cons for us is you don't really vote on the person, you're voting on your local seat, you know?
That's kind of an interesting concept. So you actually vote for your local person, and
to represent you.
To represent you. And then after they get in, then essentially the leader of the party that has the majority becomes the prime minister. How do they establish the leader of the party?
Well, just like you guys with a sort of type of primary where, you know, they might have a convention, they might have some kind of thing where they, you know, have people running to be the leader of that party. And then that's the person who's going to be their leader. And so like for most of my adult life, we went from, it was the Liberals. And then around like 2005, 2006, we went conservative, and that party had already been like a few different kind of right-wing parties that kind of joined together and became a party, so that there was more chance that they could actually defeat the Liberals one day. And then, you know, when they finally did, that guy was our prime minister for about 10 years, Stephen Harper, two minority governments, and then finally one majority government. And then this time, you know, he got toppled. And they, your question exactly was about like, how do they determine the party leader? Well, like each election that Stephen Harper was our prime minister, the Liberals had a convention to determine their leader. And, you know, like the first guy lost, so they sacked him, you know, went away and came up with another leader. That guy did worse, so they sacked him. So like get to like 2012 or so, they picked Justin Trudeau. And, you know what, I mean, of course, everyone loves him. And so this time around, he won a majority. I mean, he just is changing all sorts of things. And so it's a matter, it's very similar to like the way you guys have people who run inside, in this case, inside the party, and become the leader, or, you know, the party picks who they want to be their leader, and they try winning with him or her. In many ways, it's similar to how you guys do it, but with nuanced differences.
So well, I can definitely see the flaws and the advantages to that.
Oh yeah, there's pros and cons to the way both of our countries are doing it.
Go ahead, Travis. I heard you about to say something.
Oh, I was just gonna ask this. So basically the same way we pick the like Senate majority leader or the speaker of the House, essentially.
Yeah, I'm not 100% familiar with how you guys do that, but I mean, it sounds like it. It sounds similar.
Yes, from what I understand, I mean, it sounds to me like it's very similar. So we vote on the people that are in the Senate and the House of Representatives, and then the party actually nominates who they want to lead their party. So if it's the Senate, then you've got the Senate Majority Leader, and the minority party would have the Senate Minority Leader, and then you have the whip in both sides. So you have the majority whip and the minority whip. And then on the other side, in the House of Representatives, the majority party basically elects on the person to be the Speaker of the House, which is the third most powerful position in American government.
All right. Very, very similar, different titles. Our Speaker of the House is actually like appointed, for example, and is, you know, supposed to be like a representative of England, you know, and it's really weird and silly in some of that regard. But basically, like, whenever they've decided to dissolve government and have an election, they, you know, they ask the speaker for permission to do that, and, you know, these different formalities like that. But also one similarity, or, you know, a difference depending on how you look at it, is the party that comes in like second becomes the official opposition to the party. And so you could have, you know, we've had times in Canadian history where it went back and forth between, like, you know, liberal, conservative, you know, where there's a few guys just taking turns being, you know, prime minister and opposition, stuff like that. And there's no term limit. There's no, you know, so we've got Justin Trudeau's daddy, Pierre Trudeau, was prime minister for like 16 years in the 60s to the early 80s. With like a 9-month break in there. and, you know, there's benefits to term limits. You know, theoretically there's benefits to term limits, unless you're a Bush or a Clinton, then it doesn't really matter. but in Canada, it's like, if people keep on, you know, like Stephen Harper was running for his fourth term and, you know, Canada didn't want him anymore. Pierre Trudeau, same thing. And in the end of his term, his days, nobody wanted him anymore. Canada was sick of him. So, I mean, there's benefits to just letting someone keep running as long as the people want them to. You know, people get tired of a candidate eventually. I mean, so, like, you know, we could talk about all sorts of differences. There's pros and cons. I can totally agree with you about the cons to our system.
So getting back to the topic at hand, we were talking. I wasn't picking on you or anything. We did kind of go down a little rabbit hole, but basically, getting back to the topic at hand, electioneering in the pulpit, in my view, and it sounds like in everyone else's view on this podcast, that technically we don't agree with it, but it shouldn't be wrong. My personal view is that if you are a minister of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, and you are preaching the gospel of Christ, you should not concern yourself with worldly matters such as who the president is, because ultimately we know who's still on the throne, and that's what we should be preaching day in and day out, every single day. You have a right, personally, to speak your mind politically if you have a following on Facebook and all of that kind of stuff. But the question you should ask yourself if you are a minister is it wise to put all of your eggs in one basket when it comes to politics, and not when a few people do to your politics? Or should you preach Christ and Him crucified and win those people who otherwise may not have come to you because they were blinded by your political electioneering? That's my take on it. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. Number one objective, actually the only objective, is preach the gospel. Preach the gospel. Just, you know, stay consistent with it. I heard of this one pastor, and, you know, in the South, you know, I can't remember what nonprofit it is, but they always come to every church and, you know, about the end of October, and they hand out these little tracks that has all these stances on them, you know, like abortion, gay marriage, stuff like that, and, you know, and it always leans more Republican. And this one pastor absolutely will not let them do that because, you know, there could be a guest in the congregation that day who just heard the gospel for the first time, and she's a stark-raving liberal. But she gets that track at the door, and then she might, you know, might be kind of confused at the end of it, and it might offend her, basically. You know what I'm saying?
Right, absolutely.
Right, it could be unnecessary obstacles, right. You know, the same way we're careful of other types of obstacles with new believers, even though we know differently. Everything James said to preface his question, I agree. You know, that that law, like, it shouldn't be illegal, but that the pastor shouldn't bother doing it. I don't think, like, you know, stick our heads in the sand and pretend we have nothing to do with the things going on in our communities, which are elections and things like that as well. But at the same time, you know, just like on the outside looking in, it's pretty intense, you know, just how wedded the church and politics are in American election time compared to anywhere else I've ever lived, you know, Europe or now Peru and Canada. You guys have got some pretty intense, like, the stakes are always super high. And I think, you know, I shut some people down on my Facebook. I unfollow some people, you know, because I'm just, it's not even, you know, September yet. You know, we've still got a few more months to go. So, I mean, for what it's worth, that's some of my thoughts.
Wait, you didn't know that America was God's chosen land? I mean, come on, we got to be involved in politics.
Right. Well, if, I mean, you know, I saw somebody, I've seen two posts this week, one by one preacher and the other by another, both well known. And one said, you have a responsibility to vote for Trump, or 5 million dead babies are on, you know, the blood of 5 million dead babies is on your hands. And I'm like, I'm sorry, that's just pure manipulation. And then the other guy posted an article. Well, it was somebody posted an article by someone well known. I won't mention names, but his initials are FG. And it was like the same type of thing, you know, that you're obligated to vote for this candidate. And I'm just like, gosh, you know, I'm so glad I don't live in America where God's going to basically judge me for everything, you know, like that. It's just married into your elections a lot more, that these kind of articles and statements come out.
Well, do you think that we will be, you know, I don't want to say judged, but held accountable to who we vote for? I mean, if we were to vote for, say, Hillary Clinton, who is extremely pro-abortion. Now, the office of the president isn't going to outlaw abortion tomorrow. Okay.
Right.
But do we, you know, will we be held accountable to that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it depends on the type of rabbit trail James wants to go down with this. Obviously, you know, like if you're going to use your right to vote, you want to use it in the way that you feel matches your convictions. And I'm kind of a one issue voter myself. I mean, you know, Trudeau before, you know, shortly after becoming officially the leader of the Liberals in Canada, he made it this rule, like, you know, don't bother running in your city as a liberal if you aren't pro-abortion, you know, you're not pro-choice. And that was kind of like one of the first times in recent years I've heard a leader of a liberal left-wing party in my country do that. So, I mean, you know, I personally wouldn't know how to vote liberal if I felt like it. I wouldn't over something like that. You know what I mean? Like the party platform. So, I mean, I get like not voting over abortion, you know, and with all the nuance and other complications that are attached to that. 100%, I totally agree with that. What I was trying to emphasize is when people use that kind of stuff in this manipulative kind of way, guilt tripping and stuff like that, because I think on some level there is accountability for our actions, and that includes our votes, you know, what we are responsible for and cause to be elected, and laws we inadvertently are helping get caused to be passed. I think there's a place in that, but I don't go to bed at night worrying about that kind of stuff. You know, I just trust that God is also in control. You know what I mean? Like, I can do my part. If I have a platform like some of these guys, you know, I don't know how I would use it. I've kind of vowed on my own podcast anyway, I don't talk about politics, not coming on here. That's something else. I focus on like kingdom things that are evergreen, because, you know, election cycles are different every 4 years, you know? Right. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it depends on how you feel God's calling you and what you're supposed to do with that platform. I don't vote in American politics, so I'm just kind of bantering with you guys on this show, you know?
Well, and the thing comes down to, you know, on The Warrior's Cry, my other podcast, I kind of have the same goal in mind. I want it to be evergreen, kind of like what you talk about on your podcast, where somebody can get a podcast that maybe I recorded last year or 2 years ago or 5 years ago, and it still be relevant today. You know, with the Warriors on the Wall podcast, the goal really is to spot out things that are happening in society, talk about them, encourage people about these things, and then kind of moving on through this. And of course, we'll talk about fun subjects, and our bantering back and forth is definitely good. So, you know, the next subject that we're going to come across is and is anybody keeping time?
No, I just assumed you were.
I meant to, and I forgot to set the timer up. So,
I know what the clock says.
Well, yeah, the clock says 1 hour and 8 minutes and 51 seconds, but I don't know when we started recording.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's fine. We'll figure it out. I'll just cut this part out. All right. So, moving on to the next subject, there is an incredibly awesome thing that happens on the internet, and it's a little thing called satire. So we're going to go into talking about satire and, you know, what it's all about, and talking about the various websites and things like that. Specifically, we're going to talk about Babylon Bee, and I expect this conversation to kind of get, you know, have a little bit of fun with, but we're also going to probably have a little debate about it. So I'm going to let Steve start off talking about Babylon Bee and satire, because I know he enjoys a lot of that.
Well, I get the vibe you're not a fan of Babylon Bee. I'm not a fan. I just enjoy a good laugh, and you know, I've always been a fan of things like Onion, The Onion, Clickhole, and the Babylon Bee is a fairly recent kind of fad or whatever, and Let me talk about The Onion first. I like just something that doesn't have an agenda and makes fun of whatever's going on. Equal opportunity offender. I'm all about that kind of stuff. I enjoy posting things on the internet that are harmless, usually. And nobody has to feel like they're, you know, if they're fooled, they don't have to feel like they were tricked in like a deceptive, duplicitous kind of way. So Babylon Bee is kind of like a poor man's Christian version of The Onion. And for better or worse, I generally speaking like it. However, it is not kind of like that category I used to describe The Onion, where they're equal opportunity offenders. They really do have some of their agenda and their doctrinal point of view and stuff seep through their articles sometimes. Like, they clearly don't like charismatics. They're clearly a certain type of Calvinism or whatever. And I've seen them post stuff like that too. But sometimes their posts are just, they're not funny. And I don't mean not funny like you might not laugh, but I will. I'm not talking about like a subjective opinion, but I mean, they'll post a picture of a certain minister, and it'll say like, this is an editorial by that person. And it's just a thinly veiled like criticism written in like the first person, you know, like one was about Benny Hinn and he's like, I can't believe I'm still getting away with this. I saw one about Joel Osteen and he's like, all right, third world orphans, it's time to get with the program, you know? And so it's like, you get that the authors of these posts or the author, whoever, you know, hates certain ministers and then posts this thing under the guise of sarcasm and satire. You know what I mean? And for me, that stuff doesn't even get a laugh out of me. It's just kind of like, I wonder how they feel about that guy, you know? So I would say like on a scale of like 1 to 10, I'm like 7 or 8 with those guys. And then the 8 or 9 is sometimes like those kind of posts. What about you, Travis?
I mean, I find it, you know, relatively funny most of the time, but yeah, they do have that thinly veiled attack. I mean, I just like it because, you know, it actually makes fun of stuff that really gets under most people's nerves, but they don't want to actually come out and say it, you know what I'm saying? And then there's also those posts that it's humorous, but at the same time, very convicting. Like the one that was not too long ago, man interrupts men's breakfast over serious prayer request. That was
right.
It was funny at first, but then it was like, yeah, that's pretty true, actually, because we don't, you know, generally speaking, men's breakfast doesn't get into some, you know, deep talks and stuff like that.
But, right. And that's an example of like what I think they do right. You know what I mean? They take like a theme and that's a tightrope to walk where I think they miss it sometimes, but that's an example of, you know, they're making a good point through humor. You know what I mean? And I've seen plenty of examples when they get it right.
Well, and my thing is that the majority of the things that I see from Babylon B, that are shared on social media, from my Reformed friends, are typically very, very hateful towards charismatics or megachurches or whatever. Like there was one about, you know, Elevation Church installing a baptismal on stage with a slide or something like that. And to me, that bothers me a little bit because, I mean, that gets downright pretty close to blasphemy in my mind, because when you're looking at stuff like that, you're making fun of a legitimate ministry that is really truly bringing people into the kingdom. And, you know, with Elevation, you know, and I'm not an expert at Elevation, but I do happen to enjoy Stephen Furtick's preaching and all of that kind of stuff. And I enjoy the ministry of Elevation all around, but they are very involved in their community. And if somebody were to see that online and it caused a stumbling block for them, that could really cause a problem for the ministry that Elevation has in the community. Even if that person found out that it was satire, you know, it can really cause someone to question the ministry. And that's where I have a hard time. And then there's another one that says, worship band sliced into pieces by overpowered laser lights.
sorry. And that's one I shared.
Yeah. And then there's another one about, you know, the Holy Spirit got lost in the fog from a broken fog machine or whatever. And you know,
obviously that's heresy, but yeah.
They are mildly entertaining. And for me, it's even hard for me not to laugh at it because I get what they're attacking. But at the same time, you know, I have a hard time because you think of you think of these various ministers, and a lot of these people are doing things to reach the lost, reach the world. And Paul did that kind of stuff. I mean, laser lights didn't exist back then. Fog machines didn't exist back then. But Paul used the Olympics as a means to win people when he talked about the Olympics. He used, you know, stories about, you know, athletes and things like that, which was the big thing back then, if that makes sense. And, you know, if there had been satirical websites making fun of, you know, the Olympics when Paul was trying to use them as an example, you know, that would have been kind of an interesting concept in and of itself. Does that make sense where I'm going with that?
Oh, yeah, it does. And that's why I prefaced what I wanted to say about Babylon B with The Onion, because, like, who has an opinion of what The Onion's agenda is? Like, nobody. They make fun of Hillary. They make fun of Trump. So that they don't have some kind of agenda seeping through other than just mock, right? And so I think that's why it slips into a dangerous territory when it's specifically Christian or the church or whatever, because the people who want to run Babylon Bee or make a site like it, they have to make the choice about, like, what things are fair game and what things aren't. And then, so then we're slipping into personal convictions about, like, you know, what's funny for, not, you know, humor for one person is different for another, but what's acceptable to even be made fun of is, you know, blasphemous for one, and maybe just, you know, harmless humor for another. And so, like, that's kind of where sometimes I read their posts and I cringe. And other times, you know, the majority of times I do laugh at it, but the times I cringe is like you're saying, with that. I don't think I shared the waterside one. I don't even know if I was even mildly amused by it. But some of the other ones, like that men's prayer breakfast, you know what I mean? Like, that's a great example of them doing it right, where they're making a poignant point with humor. You know what I mean? Like, a prayer breakfast is for prayer. What's this guy doing ruining it? You know, we want to have fun. You know, he's got some prayer requests. You know, like, that was brilliant. But other times they're not so brilliant. And so I think that's the danger of niche humor, that in general, like, for example, like I always say, you can't take something seriously if you can't also make fun of it. I don't know if that's because I'm Canadian or I'm weird, but I enjoy being able to find the humor in life. In general, you know, don't hold me to that, because obviously there's some exceptions to that. But what about you, Travis? You know, just so I'm not dominating here.
Okay. The didn't Larry post a news story about this? Someone actually took that Stephen Furtick and the Elevation Church waterslide seriously.
I can't remember if I saw anything about that, but I know he posted something about the water slide thing.
I don't know, but every time I post something from The Onion or Babylon Bee or Clickhole, somebody takes it seriously. Somebody points out to me, like, hey, Steve, did you know that this is satire? So, I mean, it's par for the course.
Yeah, that's very true.
Well, and that comes back to a point that happened this last week. I got fooled by an article from abcnews.com.co, which apparently is a satire website in and of itself, but they are a website that is intentionally trying to ape people or fake people into thinking that they're a real news site, and they're posting all this stuff. They posted something about President Obama outlawing the Pledge of Allegiance in the United States. And when I first read that, I flipped a lid, you know. And we were going to talk a little bit about that because I thought it was real. And then after I dug into it a little bit, I found out that the writers of that page also have a website and a Facebook page called Fappy the Anti-Masturbation Dolphin.
Sorry.
And, you know, and I happened to look at the Facebook page for Fappy the Anti-Masturbation Dolphin. And it's hilarious. It really is hilarious. It's very vulgar, but it's hilarious. And it's like this guy that runs around in a dolphin costume, and he makes comments about, you know, in like a weird voice, hey, kids, I hope you're not masturbating so you can avoid double hell and Jesus loves you or whatever. And, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, like, this guy is morally depraved beyond bounds, but it's hilarious.
Right. Well, even that example of ABC, and, you know, I saw somebody else last night post it, and I commented and said, look, I don't think this is a real news site. And here's a couple of reasons why. Look at the sidebar and the titles of some of their other recent news. And as well, I forget what the other thing was. And he said, well, it's got the official ABC logo. And I said, yeah, but look, and I copied and pasted. It's ABC, is it abcgo.news or something like that? Some subtle difference. And then,
yeah.
No, I'm talking about the real ABC News. And I said, here, compare this, right, with that.
go.com, yeah.
And you can see they're obviously different, and that this fake news one is trying to trick people into thinking they landed on like ABC News. And I'm like, that's just not even funny. And not only is it not funny, but like there's this type of mean-spiritedness to the posts. And, you know, I'm just going to, you know, be honest. The title of the one made me laugh. I didn't read it, so I best not say it so people don't go read it and go, oh my goodness, Steve, you were talking about this. But I'm like, this is not real news. This is clearly not real news. This didn't happen. But I saw that same article get shared about 3 times. You know, you guys in our chat being the first, and then 2 more times yesterday. And my friend Praying Medic posted a thing today for how to tell before even clicking on it that something's fake. You know, because you can see in social media, at least Facebook, the link, like what the exact URL is. And, you know, so there's some tip offs to be aware of. But that's an example to me of, I don't even know what the purpose behind that is other than clicks. There's humor, there's Clickhole, there's Onion, there's Babylon Bee and stuff. Onion can be offensive, but they're like equal opportunity offensive. They have a staff, they have a team. You know what I mean? It's not just like one person's comic sensibility that dominates what kind of things they write about. And it shows, I think that's why it's kind of become the standard. You know, if somebody posts like a fake thing or whatever, people will go, is that the Onion? You know what I mean? Like it's the Onion people think of. And I think they've earned that reputation the way they do their humor. But something like faking and pretending to be pretending to be news and people falling for it. Like, I think that's not cool.
Well, and the thing that really set me off, and I just went to the website just to try to pull it up, was I went to the very bottom where it was like a listing for jobs or something like that. And about halfway through it, it basically made a comment that, you know, if you need a job, well, Fappy the anti-masturbation dolphin will help you get one. And I'm like, wait a minute. Like, seriously? And, you know, it had like Fappy the anti-masturbation dolphin like highlighted. So I clicked on it and it took me to his Facebook page. And, you know, content warning, there are some obscene images on his page. So I encourage you not to go to it unless you are mature enough to look at it. Apparently, just for your information, I just pulled it up in the abcnews.com.co. is apparently experiencing shutdown order or something. So apparently that website won't last much longer.
The link is working for me when I go to it.
Well, it locked up on me and it was like nothing on the page. And then all of a sudden it popped up and said something to the effect that kill the page because page scripts not found or something like that. I can't remember.
Yeah, I think that might be your browser.
It could be.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with the site being shut down. I have it here. It could just be that it has so much traffic. Sorry?
Oh, I'm sorry. You said it has nothing to do with that shite, but, you know.
Yeah, edit me out. It has nothing to do with that site. Same thing. Pretty much. This website is shite. Sorry if that's. But it's not what I meant to say. It's working just fine, but it took a while to load for me. It could be like, you know, it has so much traffic that maybe this site was running slow at the moment.
Yeah, I'm sure that.
So anyway,
Obama signing the anti pledge of allegiance, whatever, has gotten shared probably couple million times by now, and people are actually believing it out there, because I found it on somebody else's webpage where they were flipping out about it. And yeah, so
yeah.
But, you know, to go back to your point, I enjoy The Onion. I get a huge kick out of The Onion. Some of their stuff is obscene, but it is funny. And, you know, I had the Onion app on my phone because I enjoyed watching their weather segments and all that kind of stuff. You know, like this weatherman standing up in front of a green screen and, you know, it had like a weather map going on behind it. And he's basically, you know, he's got like a 5-day forecast and all 5 days it says it's really hot outside. Of course, he uses some obscenity there. But, you know, stuff like that is really funny to me. you know, it's funny to me and I get a kick out of it and I get it. But where it draws a line for me with Babylon Bee, and I think you made a really good point, there are times they do it right. You know, for example, I did get a kick out of a section on their website, 10 Simple Ways That You Can Encourage Your Pastor. I don't know if you've read that one. That one was really funny.
Write him a critical email.
Yeah, write him a critical email. Tell him how much you enjoyed somebody else's preaching, you know, things like that. I thought that that was funny. Because that's what people do, and you know, and that's that thin line thing. But where they start criticizing, like for example, drugged up clubber suddenly realizes she's in a church worship service. I mean, seriously, it smacks a lot of it. Smacks of like, I don't know necessarily the word, and I'm not a big fan of calling people heretics or heresy or anything like that.
Right.
But it does smack of blasphemy to me because, you know, these people are making jokes about things that they really don't understand.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, it's getting late. What's the next segment?
Next segment. Well, I was going to say that we do have a Calvinist / Pentecostal on the line. And I wanted to see what his thoughts were on all of that stuff.
Basically,
y'all done said it. Oh, did you already say it earlier? Okay, well, then we'll move on. We'll move on. So next up, we're just going to talk about just kind of random stuff that comes to our mind. So, Travis, you go ahead and start us off.
Oh, yeah? Are you sure about that?
Actually, no. We do have another section we do need to cover.
It's like, oh, no, we don't want Steve to do that.
Travis, you shared a post about a South African pastor. Let's talk about that a little bit. Talk about our thoughts on that and then kind of move on from there.
You want me to read the article or you just want me to like sum it up?
Just go ahead and summarize it.
All right. Well, basically, the South African church had a prophet, pastor, whatever you want to call him. I have a couple choice words for him, but he essentially wanted to, how's a good way to put this? Show the power of God. So he ordered a lady that was on the worship team to lay on the ground in front of the stage. Then he asked some of the ushers to grab this speaker. Now, I've got a picture of the speaker right here, and that joker is huge. That's a big speaker. He lays it on top of this little bitty woman and saying that, you know, God can lift it off of her, which, you know, we all know he can, but still, it's stupid to do something like that. And then he proceeds to sit on it for 5 minutes. So that's close to 250-300 pounds on top of that lady, which causes her lungs to not be able to get filled with oxygen, which causes her to be passed out and a couple of broken ribs. She winds up dying. And probably the most disgusting part of this is the last little paragraph in most of the articles that I've seen. It says, the pastor blamed the girl and accused her of having little faith, for she could not withstand a very simple task. That's disgusting.
Yeah, we better move on if you want me to say more than shite.
Yeah.
What bugs me is at least the way that article or whatever portrays it, that he puts the blame like on her. Whose idea was it for her to lie down? Did she go, you know what? I think I should lie down and you should put this on me and sit on top of it. I doubt it. You know, I bet there was some I don't want to say coercion, but who comes up with that on their own, you know? But that's just garbage. And that's not somebody I think should be allowed to preach anything to anyone, but...
Well, and that also brings up a point, you know, about, like, for example, snake handling churches. Like, you know, the Bible tells us that, you know, if we're in a field and we're bitten by a snake, then, you know, well, it's not really talking about us, but it's, I think it's, was it Paul that he was bitten by a snake and he was able to shake it off because he was under, Stevie can probably correct me on that, or Travis.
Yeah, but yeah. With Paul, it happened to him. It wasn't like he brought these.
Right. And that's what my point is. You know, it happened. It was happenstance. It happened. And because of God, he was able to survive. You know, if you take up snakes, you'll survive, et cetera. But it's not meant to be the scenario where, you know, hey, let's take the speaker and throw it on top of you and see if you survive. You know, that's testing, you know, that's testing God, and, you know, or tempting God, as Jesus said when he was being tempted by Satan in the desert. You know, he said, "You shall not tempt the Lord thy God," when Satan had asked him to jump off the top of the temple. And that's where my struggle is with that. What do you think?
I don't even like know where to even begin. I know not all churches in that part of the world is like that, but I've seen way too many stories, especially researching this guy. You know, I mean, I've seen at least five stories in just the short 15 minutes I was, you know, trying to do the research on this guy about pastors just manipulating and mishandling their congregation. And most of them tend to drape over that charismatic cloak, and, you know, they call themselves charismatic or Pentecostal or whatever you want to call them. It's, you know, kind of all the same camp. And I don't see a whole lot of outrage and calling them out about it, you know? Of course, we probably don't know it. You get where I'm going with this?
Well, and my thought about that is that, you know, when I immediately read that article and you started bringing up some other stories about stuff that you were researching, my thought about this is, it could it be possibly that charismatics went over into Africa and, you know, maybe put on like mission meetings and pastoral trainings and stuff like that, and then left before these guys were ready to really take over, and they just don't really understand? Or do you think they're actually doing this kind of thing maliciously? I mean, some of it sounds malicious. I mean, you posted something about how one pastor ordered a woman to commit, for lack of a better term, oral sex to receive the milk of the word or something like that.
And, what?
Yeah.
The milk of healing.
The milk of healing, yes.
Oh, and, my goodness.
Yeah, and when I read stuff like that, I'm like, yeah, this guy, you know, he literally was just a sexual predator. But I wonder how much of it is, does it make sense what I'm saying? I wonder how much it is that they don't know any better. And
well, I have a theory about that, and we definitely don't have time to talk about that tonight. From my angle, living here in Peru, mingling with a variety of other missionaries, discipling people from the jungle who tell me weird stories of things other missionaries had gone in the last 50 years and taught them. There's definitely something to be said about, you know, it's like you leave your home country and you go somewhere else in the world. And, you know, to the far reaches of the world, maybe out in the middle of nowhere. And some people, you know, how Paul said to, I think it was the Corinthians, "You are my epistle." Well, some people are your epistle, for better or worse. So if you have some weird doctrines and stuff, for better or worse, you're transferring some of those things over, you know. I'll give you a less harmful example. You know, some of the students in our school come from this jungle called Pucallpa. And one of them was telling me that like 50 years ago, it was missionaries from, I don't remember if they said like South Korean missionaries or some other nationality. And that when they went into the jungle, the people were very hospitable and wanted to serve them and give them things. And these missionaries kept saying, no, we can't take from you. We're here to give you. And they said that like so many times that it got to a point where there was etched in these people's minds, in this tribe or in this area, okay, missionaries come to give us stuff. You get what I'm saying? Like, even if it was, no, I mean, we came to bring the gospel. We came to make disciples. We came to, you know, plant the kingdom of God here. And yes, we have more resources and we're able to help and contribute. So to tie that all around, somewhere along the line, there became this idea, we're the poor, you know, tribes people, you're the rich missionary, you're here to give us stuff. Like somewhere along the line, whether that was the intention of the original missionaries who went to that area or not, that's what wound up happening.
Right.
Yeah. It for good or bad. And so if you've got some missionaries and you don't know anything about them, I mean, again, this is a whole can of worms for another day, another topic. I can send you a link to something I wrote one time about it, where if you don't know the missionaries and, or maybe they are professional preachers or something, and you don't know what they believe, where they stand on things, and you're complicit in laying hands on them and sending them off into the, you know, the tribes of Africa or something. You know, if they believe some wonky doctrine, and they're teaching that, and then the people that that got that version of the gospel, they multiply and they disciple and carry it forward. You know, like I think there is a mixture of things like that predator, and somewhere they learned nonsense like that. You know what I mean? Like maybe that guy with the big speaker or whatever on the girl, somebody taught him, or he saw somewhere, or he learned to do that, but probably mixed in with his own stupidity or something. You know what I mean? So I have a lot of thoughts on what stuff is not worth taking to the mission field in your doctrinal arsenal and what things are, what happens. You know, I could go for a while on that. Well, let's say you, Travis. Oh, sorry.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why I just personally, you know, and I think we've had this conversation before, whether it be on recording or not, that I have a problem pretty much with intense theological debate, because sometimes I think theology leads down the path of some crazy thoughts sometimes, because theology is our way of explaining God. Whereas I think, you know, the gospel and what we're really supposed to be doing is not preaching theology, but preaching Christ and Him crucified. And I think sometimes when we get off on these theological discussions and debates and things like that, if we're talking to these people that are out in the middle of nowhere, people that have never heard of Christ, and we're having these theological debates, could it be that they're hearing this stuff and with their primitive understanding, taking it beyond what the intention was there? Is that what you were getting at, Steve?
Yes and no. You added some good stuff to what I did say. 90-second nutshell. There's three important aspects of disciple making. I borrow from a guy named Mike Breen. There's information, imitation, and innovation, right? You can teach information, but people imitate you as well. And then those people will go and innovate and do disciple making their own way. So like there's this kind of triangle, I would diagram of that. A lot, you know, pulpit to the pew, you know, a pastor, someone like that, that's information. You know, imitation would come, you know, spending time, people getting to have access to you. And then the innovation would be they might, you know, you might be discipling someone and they're a worship leader, even though you're not, you know, they'll probably do stuff that's more musically inclined. They'll do this their own way. Okay. So I said 90 seconds, right? People pick up an awful lot of imitation. You know, you could teach certain things from the pulpit, but people who are around you a lot will imitate your life. Doesn't matter what you preach, you know? So there's somewhere along the way where preachers like that, with their theatrics and so on, they're imitating on some level something they learned somewhere. You know, people don't 100% come up with that kind of stuff on their own. You know, so whether this guy in whatever country it was, whether he learned that from some really theatrical Pentecostal preacher or something, you know, we can only speculate. But I'm saying from my time on the mission field so far, I wouldn't put it past him, you know, if he learned that kind of stuff and to minister that way from someone who mentored him, from someone who discipled him, whether it's, you know, from outside or somebody in his own culture. That kind of stuff happens all the time in good ways too. I mean, we're really focusing on the hardcore bad, you know, examples we just kind of talked about, but there's information, imitation, innovation, and you can only teach so much, but you reproduce who you are.
Well, and that goes back to some good points as well, is, you know, that I've learned in leadership training is, you know, good leaders create good leaders. And if you're a bad leader, you're only going to create a bad leader. And I think that probably comes down to that point as well. Travis, you got anything to add to that?
Yeah. All right. So I'm trying to word this because I lost my train of thought. Whenever Paul was setting up his churches, well, you know, the churches that he was over, you know, he was essentially doing the same thing that's happening down in, you know, Africa and South Africa, you know, basically unchurched people that's never heard the gospel. They have no presuppositions or anything, but he also corrected them. Like you said something about theological debates, and while I agree with that, at the same time, you know, there's certain things that can't go on. If I'm making sense? Making sense right now? Or am I totally off the rabbit trail?
No, you're making sense.
Okay. But, I just want to know, and it's not just over in South Africa. I've seen crazy stuff over here, too. Okay? But, like, what? How did something like that get so far off a biblical basis? You know, like where did it all start? Like, why? And why are we just now addressing it when someone finally dies? You know.
Well, I believe some of that stuff started because a move of God happened and some crazy things happened, and as a result, people try to recreate those things by creating formulas, and they try to achieve those things with those formulas, like. There was a lot of that at Brownsville.
Oh, yeah.
There was a lot of that at Brownsville. You know, there was all sorts of things like that were coming out of the Brownsville revival for years after that, of people with, you know, gold flakes appearing in their hair and, you know, their fillings in their teeth turning to gold and all this kind of stuff. And
you know, Pastor Kilpatrick used to say that that light attracts flies. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to have silliness in there. And you're going to need discernment. You're going to need to know what's that pastor's personal opinion and what's actual Bible to, you know, to sort through the, anyway, I sounded like I was cutting you off, Travis.
Well, Robert, but at the same time, at, you know, Brownsville, there might've been crazy stuff happening, which, you know, I'm still studying all that and stuff like that. Anyways, but, there was also a, you know, a speaker preaching repentance consistently. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Steve Hill.
Right. And in a lot of these places, it's the prosperity gospel seems like it's almost taken over.
Well, and the prosperity gospel, unfortunately, blew up as a result of Brownsville, because even though you had Steve Hill preaching repentance, you had Michael Brown and Kilpatrick and all of these great men of God down there. You had people that were hearing bits and pieces and people experiencing God in such a way that was beyond their own understanding. Like there was, I can't remember her name. I think her first name was Allison, but she shook. She was a Quaker of sorts, and she shook. And she came to my church and she preached the week before Steve Hill preached. She didn't really preach, but she came up and shared, and she shook the entire time she shared at my church. And I'll tell you, that particular event was a big impact on me, because I swear I saw Jesus standing there while she was shaking. But you know, when you take stuff like that and you try to create a formula around that, and you try to inject that formula at other meetings and other places, then sometimes crazy things can come as a result of that. Now, you know, who knows? Maybe somebody's hair did have gold flakes in it, or somebody's fillings turned to gold when the Spirit of God came out somewhere. But then what happened was somebody saw that and they took it somewhere else and they said, well, if we do this, this, and this, this will happen. And, you know, if we do this, this, and this, this will continue happening. And then, you know, same thing happened. Somebody that might have been affiliated with that might have went to South Africa and taught this pastor down there and said, if we do this, this, and this, this will happen. And then he took it and with that same formula said, if we do this, this, and this, something else will happen. And then ultimately, crazy things like this are bred from things like that. It's from where we try to add our own understanding, our own thought processes, our own thoughts around this thing. And that's what I was talking about with theology, because theology really is man's understanding of God and our study of God. Theology is not necessarily godly in and of itself. Theology is just our understanding of Scripture. Who knows? Our theology could be completely off and way off, and we won't understand that, and we won't know that until we're standing in the presence of God. You know, and I mean, that's really my thoughts on that.
Okay, so you're basically kind of talking about the signs and wonders that go with flakes and all that stuff. And while all that stuff is good, I believe that a lot of the Pentecostal and charismatic churches, not all of them, but, you know, a good portion of them are looking at the signs and wonders, but not what comes before that, which is repentance. You know what I'm saying? Like they're simply, you know, preaching the healings, the, you know, the spectacular, but they're not preaching the what's the word? The foundation, I guess you would say. Do y'all agree with that, or am I totally off base?
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at the hour, and I feel like we need to wind this up, so I'm disciplining myself to not have more to say about that tonight.
Well, we do need to cut the call off because we have gone a little longer, I totally repent because I forgot to record or write down the time to know when to stop recording. So this will probably be a very long episode. So to wrap it up, you can follow us on facebook.com/The Warrior's Cry. Go ahead and like our page. And on that page, you'll see posts concerning my other podcast, as well as posts concerning Warriors on the Wall and whatever else that we come up with in the future. You can follow the podcast directly on, you can follow it directly on iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Google Play Music, directly on our webpage, wherever else you want to listen to podcasts, you can find us there. And you can email me directly at thewarriorscry@gmail.com if you have any suggestions about future shows or anyone else that you might want to suggest for maybe an interview or whatever, you know. So just email us, join in the conversation at The Warriors Cry on Facebook.com. And I'm going to let Travis and Steve go ahead and say how you can follow them and tell us a little bit about their ministries directly.
Yeah, stevebremner.com. That's all you need to know. And search the tabs. I've got what we do in Peru. Got my own podcast, Fire in Your Head. I try to write and be blogging. I've got books, you know, and it's not hard to find how to buy those from stevebremner.com.
I don't have any other pages, but make sure you subscribe.
And you can find Travis on Facebook if you want to follow him, where he likes to write a lot of thoughts, because he is our ghostwriter.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to finish off the episode. So join us next time when we talk about the moon.
This is Warriors on the Wall on Warriors Cry Network. Check out our other podcasts on iTunes, Pocket Cast, TuneIn Radio, the web, or wherever else you like to listen.